Welcome to Michigan Writers on the Air, a program about writers, writing, reading, and listening here in northern Michigan. I'm Aaron Stander. On this edition of Michigan Writers on the Air, Julie Bunton will be here to read from and talk about her terrific debut novel, Marlena. Next, writer and conservationist Heather Shoemaker will tell us about her new book, Saving Arcadia. Then fiction writer Nancy Parshall will read a short story from her prize-winning chapbook. And at the end, Fleeta Brown will provide a commentary on poet Kevin Gooden. It's with pleasure that I welcome Julie Bunton to Michigan Writers on the Air. Welcome, Julie.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
So you're back in the home territory, aren't you?
Mm-hmm. Yep, for the first time in a few years.
And you went to the Interlochen Arts Academy. You grew up in Petoskey.
Mm-hmm.
And since graduating, boy, I look at your CV and it's incredibly impressive.
Thank you.
You've published in The Atlantic, Cosmopolitan, O, the Oprah Magazine, Slate, Electric Literature, and you are the director of writing programs at Catapult.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Catapult's an independent literary publishing startup based in New York City and also in Berkeley because we have merged with Counterpoint and Soft Skull, which is a bigger independent publisher. And we have a creative writing program. So I run our classes and online classes.
And you live in Brooklyn,
mm-hmm.
which is a long way from Petoskey.
It's true. It's a long way from Petoskey.
And today we're talking about your debut novel, Marlena, which has really gathered positive reviews, and it was published in April by Henry Holt and Company. Could you give our listeners some background about this book and the subject matter and the intended audience?
Yeah, sure. So I think of it as a coming-of-age story at its heart. It's narrated by a woman in her early 30s who's looking back on a formative friendship that lasted a really brief time, about a year, with an older girl who was 15 to her 17 at the time, that ended in tragedy, related in some ways to her friend Marlena's substance abuse issues. I think of it really as about grief and loss and also kind of the intensity of female friendship, the attraction of, or the vulnerability of adolescence and the attraction girls might feel to dangerous behaviors. And I do think it's a book for adults, really, more so than teenagers, but there is a strong female friendship at the core, and the girls are teenagers for a lot of the book. So, you know, I found that it does resonate, or it seems to be resonating with girls who are like 17, 18, 19, 20.
Yeah, that was interesting when I was looking at the reviews, and some people want this to be a young adult novel.
Mm-hmm.
Other people say this is an adult novel.
Yeah.
And they also say it's a novel for women, but it seems to me it has a very universal quality to it.
Thank you. Yeah, I think of it, I mean, I definitely was writing, for me, this, it's so much about girlhood that I was thinking so much about what it means to kind of have that intense friendship, what it means to be a girl kind of unsure about what you're allowed to be or what people think you should be. But yeah, I'm always really happy when men say that they something in it resonated with them, because you hope that the things that you write, you know, have that universal quality.
Well, in a lot of ways, it reminded me of A Separate Piece by John Knowles.
Oh, I love that book so much. Yeah.
Could you give us a little background on Kat and Marlena?
Yeah. So Kat, in the telling of the book, is in her early 30s, and she's revisiting this friendship for a couple of reasons. She's kind of been triggered. These memories have been triggered by the appearance of someone from her past sort of pops up in her life very unexpectedly. And so that sends her back. But also she's in sort of a precipice in her own life with her relationship to alcohol. And she's feeling kind of stuck for reasons that the book gets into. So she thinks back to this memory of having been 15 and kind of falling in love with a girl who's a little older than her, a little wilder than her, Marlena, her neighbor. Their friendship is really a product of sort of random circumstance and the fact that they're neighbors. But it also, I think, has that kind of special quality that so many adolescent friendships have, where it's like sparks, you know, the kind of magical feeling where you think, like, you see the world like I do. We're together. We're in this together. And yeah, I mean, their friendship to me was really about this act of collaboration in some ways, or this creative act, girls finding their identity through the reflections of each other, and the kind of empowering act of friendship.
Perhaps you'd read a few pages at the front to give us a sense.
Sure. So I'll read a little bit from the beginning of the book, and then I'll maybe flash a little deeper into that section too. Tell me what you can't forget, and I'll tell you who you are. I switch off my apartment light, and she comes with the dark. The train's eye widens in the tunnel, and there she is on the tracks, blonde hair swinging. One of our old songs starts playing, and I lose myself right in the middle of the cereal aisle. Sometimes, late at night, when I'm fumbling with the key outside my apartment door, my eyes meet my reflection in the hallway mirror, and I see her, waiting. Marlena and I are in Ryder's van. That morning, while he was still asleep, she stole the keys from the pocket of his jeans. The springs burst gloriously, stupidly into summer, and we're wearing drugstore flip-flops, hair tacky with salt at the temples, breath all cigarettes and cherry lip gloss in yesterday's wine. I kick my sandals off and unfold my legs on the dash, press my toes against the windshield the way I do when it's just Marlena and me. Ryder says I've ruined his car, that the spots won't rub off, but I don't care. Marlena painted my nails, propping my foot on her thigh. High alert orange, her color. Our windows are rolled all the way down. The breeze loosens the hair from my ponytail, sends it in tangles across my face so that everything I see is broken. We're on our way to the beach for a normal day, for holding our breath underwater until our lungs beg, for the breath-stealing slap of a wave against our stomachs and sour, fizzy mouthfuls of beer stolen from unattended coolers. We'll track the sun's movement with the angles of our towels and pass the same two magazines back and forth until the light sinks into the water. When we leave, unburying our feet from cold sand, we'll have sunburns, then fevers. We're pretending to be girls with minor secrets, listening to Joni Mitchell with the volume turned up. Every line is a message written just for us. I sing so loud Marlena can't hear herself, tells me shh, tells me I'm making her brain hurt. But in this memory, I only sing louder. Marlena puts pressure on the gas and the car climbs the big hill on the dead-end road that leads to the lake. The speedometer leaps. We pass 55, the limit on country roads, and hit 70 within a minute. The car fills with wind, so pushy and loud, my hair whips against my neck and I can't hear the music anymore. I try to roll my window up, but Marlena locks it from her side. When she looks at me, grinning, I feel the car edge over to the shoulder, tires spitting gravel. She swerves back into the lane and the speedometer quivers before it jumps up again. Marlena's ponytail has almost fallen out and I wonder whether she can see, if maybe she doesn't realize we're up to 90 now and that underneath the wind there's a new smell, bitter and hot, the van's organs burning. We go faster and faster. I giggle a little and tell her to slow down, and a few seconds later to please slow down. And when she doesn't answer, I shout that she's crazy and scaring me, and I want to get out of the car and that we're going to die, please. She's going to kill us. We hit 100 miles per hour, zipping up another hill, the car thrumming. When we reach the top, the tires lift off the pavement, and when we land, I slam against the glove compartment, catching myself with my forearms. She doesn't brake, and I wrestle my seatbelt on. Lake Michigan, Caribbean blue and winking light, rears up in our faces. We're half a mile or less from the drop-off, the parking lot, the path to the beach. And then I'm going to read a little bit from a little bit later in this section, really just about a page and a half deeper into the first chapter, in which you kind of find out what you think you would find out at the end of the book, which is that Marlena does not survive. Marlena suffocated in less than 6 inches of ice-splintered river in the woods on the outskirts of downtown Kewaunee, a place she had no reason to be at twilight in November. She was wearing one of my old coats and a pair of chewed-up Keds that the police would make much of. The tote bag she carried was full of loose change that must have rattled as she walked against that prescription bottle, her pay-as-you-go flip phone. She struck her head neatly, brutally on a river boulder, and it is assumed her body slid just so, unconscious, until mouth and nostrils were submerged in water. Some of the details are facts, but very few, what she was found, what she wore and carried. She was last seen alive at 5:12 p.m., according to Jimmy, my older brother, whose memory of those three numbers blinking on the car clock is distinct. Though, he told me later, frustrated, drunk, he could be remembering what the clock read in the minutes just after she got in the car. It's possible, he said, that 5:12 p.m. was the time he left the house, before he even picked her up. I understand why it bothered him so much not knowing the timeline for sure. Neither of us really believes that what happened to her was pure accident.
We find out in the first chapter a little bit about the narrator and about Marlena. But then for the next 200 and some pages, or the next 15 years in the character, you know, about 15 years?
Yeah, it's about 15. Really, technically, it's 17.
Okay. For the next 17 years, the narration goes forward, but we're going forward and backward.
Mm-hmm.
Was that tough to write? I mean, it just seemed like you had so many balls in the air at one time trying to, and was it difficult to make sure that the reader always knew where you were?
Yeah, that's a great question. Yes and no. I mean, one thing that was really important to me in thinking about developing Kat's character and really Kat's voice, to me, this book, it was all about the voice. It was finding Kat's voice and making that feel as authentic and true as possible. And I wanted a lot of range as a writer in her voice. So
It was a changing voice too over the years, a maturing voice.
Right. And how could I make her voice in the past kind of reflect her adolescent mindset? And then, you know, how could I kind of use all the tools that you can use in a voice to reflect her different, like when she's getting a little drunk, for example, mm-hmm. But I knew that I couldn't tell the story from Kat just as a teenager as it was unfolding, because then for me as a writer, as much as I love teenagers and I love teenage girls as protagonists, they're so fascinating to me. But like, I would have had to be limited by the kind of wisdom that you have as a teenager, which is just not enough, kind of. Like, I wanted to both write about how stupid teenagers can be, how wise they can be, how full of emotion they can be, but then also have all the psychic matter of the years since that time to kind of bounce Kat's perceptions off of, I guess. So I always knew that it was going to be narrated from this distant place, this retrospective voice. But the really careful kind of framing didn't come into the structure of the novel until many drafts in, thinking a lot about transitions and breaking off the New York section so that they were more clearly defined and not kind of bleeding into the narrative that the way that they were in earlier drafts. It was a little bit more like we were always in this memory space. And in later drafts, I thought like this needs to be clearer, also to help amplify the contrast between kind of how vivid Kat's life felt as a teenager and how numb it feels as an adult. I wanted those New York sections to feel a little gray in comparison, a little bit flat. And I thought by setting them off like that, I could help build that contrast, which might be narratively interesting.
Could you see this in your draft, or did you have readers who were mentioning
helping
it?
Me? Yeah, that's a good question. I could see it a little bit. I definitely, a lot of this, my editor was amazing. She's no longer an editor, and it's like the biggest tragedy in publishing. She left to be an agent, but I got to work with her, and I'm forever grateful for that. But she really, I sold the book, and there were still the kind of alternating New York, Michigan sections, but it was in my conversations with Sarah, whose editing style was really a lot about asking questions, that I began to, in answering her questions, kind of see what needed to be clear or help define things in the actual framing of the novel.
And how many years did this take?
A kind of a long time, actually. I'm sort of only realizing it now. Like, if you count the editing process, which I probably was working on kind of editing for about a year and a half after the book sold, or maybe not that whole time, but it was about a year and a half before publication after the sale. So probably 6 or 7 years. I first started writing scenes with these girls in them when I was probably like 23. Though those pages, almost not a single one of them made it into the final draft, but I was doing kind of character work for a long time. I actually wrote another novel during that time as well, but that was just a bad book. So this is the one that made it.
What really impressed me was how much this book is about place and how much this book is about the economics and sociology of this region, and how you subtly work that into these characters.
Thank you. Yeah, I thought about that a lot. I mean, I think Northern Michigan is fascinating. The economics, the way that money functions in this area is really interesting to me. I think it's a little uncomfortable to talk about, but and everyone's experience of place is different. And I don't mean to like apply a kind of overview, like this is the way it is, but I wanted to talk about what it's like to be up against kind of working for summer people, say, relying on them for income. Then the different levels of kind of class strata just within like a small town. You have your doctors and lawyers and teachers, but then you also have the people who only wash windows in the summer. How does that look and feel different than the people who have those white collar jobs? And then the huge amounts of money that come pouring in the summer and change everything and then are gone. What does that do to a place? And what does that do to a teenager also thinking about their own future and their own place in the world?
Yeah, and without being preachy at all, it's just a reality that you worked into the plot so beautifully. Was it helpful to be at a great distance from this place to write this book? I mean, I'm putting you in Petoskey, and I'm putting Hemingway in Petoskey, who went to Paris and wrote about living on Walloon Lake. What did distance do for you?
Absolutely. I mean, I don't think I could have written, even coming back now for the first time, like in a while, I could not. If you're in a place and you're trying to write about it, you're up against the reality of the place in a way that I think would have been really challenging for me as a novelist, because I don't want to be loyal to the facts. Like, I mean, there are certain elements of this book that have a basis in some personal experience. Obviously, I grew up in northern Michigan, so that's one big thing. But like, I don't want to have to be loyal to any objective truth. I just want to like do my thing. I mean, which seems a little bit. I want it to have some basis in reality to feel authentic and to feel true. But if I were living in Petoskey and trying to write this, I would probably feel like I had to represent it the way it is now. And then also, I mean, one kind of convenient thing about the narrative perspective is that like me, one thing Kat and I share is just that like we're both displaced Midwesterners in a city kind of longing for home. So I was able to channel some of my own true feelings of wanting to go home and wanting to go back to a place that honestly doesn't really exist anymore. The way that none of our like adolescent hometowns ever stay the same. Or ever are quite what we thought they were. They just exist in this memory space. So I definitely needed that distance for sure, I think.
So this novel has been very successful for you. What's next?
Yeah, I started another novel last fall when I put this one to bed, so to speak. But I got a little derailed because the promotional, the day yes. job plus the promoting this book, it's been a little bit like, it's like my brain is like dunked in some kind of crazy. I'm just not quite myself. I'm like a little all over the place. But I'm hoping to get back to it once all the tour stuff dies down. I was actually thinking about setting my next book at a boarding school. So I'm sure Interlaken will be happy to hear that. But that was sort of the setting that I was sketching out. But from the perspective of, I'm always interested in teenagers, but this, I'm feeling a little bit ready to write with broader strokes. The intimacy of the first person voice was so, it got a little exhausting after a while. And I kind of want to write about more characters, and I don't know that I want to write in first person, and I want to kind of stretch a little bit.
If listeners want more information about you or this book, where's the best place to go?
So you can find information on my website. It's just juliebunton.com. Also, I'm on Twitter, @JulieBunton, Instagram @JulieBunton.
And Facebook.
Oh, and Facebook. I'm not on Facebook as much as, as Twitter and Instagram, but also I'm always happy to get emails and to hear from readers. So please reach out if you read it and you have any questions about, you know, why some of the place names are not names you'll recognize as Michiganders. I would love to hear from you.
Julie Bunton, my congratulations on your remarkable debut novel.
Thank
Bravo.
You. Thank you.
And thank you for being here.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
I'm delighted to welcome Heather Shoemaker back to Michigan Writers on the Air. Heather, when you were last here, we were discussing your then newest book, It's Okay to Go Up the Slide, Renegade Rules for Raising Confident and Creative Kids. And now we move on to another side of your life. In fact, we sort of move back to an earlier passion, Saving Arcadia, a story of conservation and community in the Great Lakes. Two very different books. Could you tell us about Saving Arcadia?
I'd be glad to. Yes, some people who know me as a parenting author are surprised when I come out with an environmental book about the Great Lakes. But really, those who know me well know that this is my background. I went to graduate school in environmental studies, and I've done most of my professional career in land conservation. So this is really coming home.
And you've written several other books about these kind of issues.
I've written several locally published books about environmental nonprofits, yes, including the Inland Seas Schooner and Grass River Natural Area. But telling you about Saving Arcadia, it's a sweeping saga, really. It covers a 40-year time period, including starting the year I was born, which is 1969.
That makes it easy to remember.
Makes it easy to remember, but hard to write. In fact, I was kicked out of a memoir class because I was told I wasn't writing memoir because I was writing about things that happened really before I was born. So this is what's called creative nonfiction, which means it's a true story, it's nonfiction, but it's told with the flair of fiction, you know, with plot and characters and suspense. So this is a very different read. It reads like a novel, and it's about our landscape in northern Michigan. It's about the Lake Michigan coast and about a really dedicated group of people from all cross sections of life who came together to create something wonderful, which is the Arcadia Dunes Nature Preserve, which we know and love today.
So early on, this area belonged to farmers, and who owned the waterfront area?
Yeah, this is a, when we talk about Arcadia Dunes, it's approximately a 6,000 acre landscape. And back the year I was born, 1969, it was owned by a whole patchwork of families, but mostly farm families who were orchard farmers primarily, cherries and apples, and some people who owned woodlots. And private people owned the shoreline as well as some of the inland acreage. And Consumers Power, which is a public utility in Michigan, decided to use this land for a pump storage facility, which is like the one in Ludington that they did build. It's high land that they flood and then use to fill with water and release that water during times of peak energy demand. So they were going to flood the area after they consolidated all the ownership. So they sent someone who at the time was a mysterious stranger to go knocking on doors and see if he could buy the farmers' lands. And some of them had been farming it for generations at that point.
And eventually they didn't do this, but they still owned the land. And there were people who really dreamed about protecting the land. Who were the early dreamers? And what was the effort to organize and to save these dunes?
Well, I think with a landscape this big and this amazing, there's always many layers of dreamers. So some of the dreamers were the farm families who dreamed about getting their land back because Consumers did consolidate it all into one ownership. And so some of the farmers were dreaming about reclaiming that land and continuing to farm it for their next generations. But there were other people with other dreams. And one of them is the Resort family who run the Watervale Inn just right next to the Consumers Energy property. And they had all kinds of ideas about how to stop massive development of this property. In fact, right after some of the Consumers representatives sent somebody with a large offer to buy the Watervale Inn, this is how they reacted. "We've got to stop them. We'll form a new society, the Watervale Preservation Society." "Well, if they open a resort, they'll need a beer and wine license for that," said Dory. The rest of them looked at her. "There's only one beer and wine license available in Blaine Township. If we get the license first, that's how we'll stop them." So before long, Watervale was the triumphant holder of Blaine Township's single liquor license. "You did what?" said Dory's friend Reg. She explained her strategy. "Well, now you can serve wine at weddings. Look, you need something stronger than that." And he told her about land trusts like the newly formed Grand Traverse Regional Land Conservancy. "Sign us up," said Dory, "and quickly. As the man who pumped the septic tank said, what are you going to do when they add a few more zeros to that offer?"
So the stakeholders, the people who were interested in this, there were the farmers, there were the resorters, who else?
Well, there's many people who have fallen in love with this property because after the plans to flood the land fell through, the land sat largely vacant for a number of decades. And during that empty, idle time, people fell in love with it.
So, we should locate this for our listeners if they're unfamiliar with the area.
Yeah, we're talking about land on Lake Michigan coast in the southern part of Benzie County and the northern part of Manistee County.
So we're just south of Frankfort.
South of Frankfort and a little bit north of the village of Arcadia.
Okay. So people are falling in love and...
Well, when hearts get tied to land, it's very hard to disengage that. So when generations of people begin to fall in love with a piece of land, it's extremely strong bond. And years later then, when the opportunity came up to try to buy this land from Consumers Power, or CMS Energy as the parent company is called, there were many hearts invested in this project. People who'd come up and summered at various summer camps, people who lived nearby, people who lived a long way away and had never seen the property but remembered land on on Lake Michigan or other beaches that they just loved as a child. So sometimes it wasn't the very local ones who fell in love, but people almost fell in love by proxy. Because once you love a wilderness or the Great Lakes or a landscape, it's impossible to stop that love from flowing out.
So the actual project that you were involved in passionately for quite a number of years, when did that start and how did that unfold?
Well, I joined, I moved to Michigan in my 20s to work for the Grand Traverse Regional Land Conservancy, which is a land trust working in five counties here based in Traverse City. And I was handed Benzie County to take care of. So I was told, go talk to landowners who'd be voluntarily interested in preserving land in Benzie County. And my eyes fell on a map of ownership that showed a huge block of land in southern Benzie County. And I thought, wow, what's this? So let me just read you a bit from the book that tells how I discovered this property. I was new to dune and cherry country, but I knew about fragmented forests. For most natural habitat preservation, it all comes down to this. Big is better. Big blocks are better yet. At the bottom of Benzie County lay the biggest block of land in the plat book. I couldn't keep my eyes off it. Why was there such a big parcel of land in Blaine Township? The land stretched 6 miles across, 2,000, maybe 3,000 acres, all with one name marking it, CMS Arcadia Land. What do you know about this land? I asked Glenn, showing him the plat book. Glenn Chown glanced at the map and smiled. Ah, so you found Consumers.
Consumers?
Yeah, Consumers Power, the biggest public utility in Michigan. The parent company is CMS Energy.
It's big, I said.
Oh, it's big, Glenn agreed. It goes into Manistee County, too. The whole thing's 6,000 acres.
You mean I'm only seeing half of it?
That afternoon, I sat in Glenn's office as the April wind rattled the windows. The snow had melted into a slushy heap and flooded the grass, just as Consumers might have flooded the Arcadia land. I learned how Consumers had consolidated the land beginning the year I was born, how its plans had failed and the land lay idle, waiting for a new vision. When I left Glenn's office, I had stars in my eyes. The land was bigger than I'd thought. It was entirely clear of houses. Most of it was natural, and the dune was bound to have rare species of global significance. That day, I determined to save Old Baldy and the back acreage on Dry Hill, land I'd never seen. This was what I had come to Michigan for.
Bravo, and you did it. Could you walk us through the chronology, the years of struggle to raise the money and convince Consumers to sell it to you, and The book has heartbreak and triumph over and over and over again.
Yeah, it's rather an action thriller. It may be hard to think of a real estate deal and fundraising campaign as an action thriller, but that's really what it felt like living through it. And that's what readers have told me it feels like when you read it. It's just cliffhanger at every moment.
First, I was one part of this effort. I happened to be behind the scenes in some of the real estate negotiation and can tell that story as the guide. But there were 5,000 people part of saving Old Baldy, the North Bluff. It has many names. The chronology of it really, there was an intense time, one summer in particular, the summer of 2003, where we had to raise $5 million in one summer from Memorial Day to Labor Day. And if we didn't, the whole deal would fall apart. So many people flocked to help in that. But I think some of the drama that people don't know about is the negotiations themselves. Because what's interesting is it was a clash of cultures of the corporate world of CMS Energy and the nonprofit Summer Michigan world of all these people who love beaches. And you put the two together and they don't necessarily understand each other. So we had a lot of challenges just trying to get CMS Energy to talk to us and believe that we were a reliable buyer. They were much more used to working in the business world and working with a developer. They understood that model. So some of the drama comes in bridging that cultural gap and getting them to realize that, yes, this little nonprofit can do it. And they needed to, in some ways, make a leap of trust that we could pull off what we said we could. And then, of course, once we convinced them that we could be that audacious and raise all this money, then we actually had to do it.
And there were sort of endless wine and cheese parties, coffees, all kinds of gatherings to help bring money in.
There was everything. We tried everything, you know, boat rides and donated loaves of bread and everything you can think of, including, as you mentioned, wine, cheese, house parties. We worked extremely hard. We wrote grants. There were the raising the money and also just bringing the community support together. It was a huge community effort, and it brought people together who normally didn't interact. So sometimes some summer resorters who might never have met the farmers down the street were suddenly all in this together with different aspects of it, but they were all working towards the same goal.
So how many years does this take?
It's hard to pinpoint a date because negotiations went on for several years behind the scenes, and then fundraising went on publicly for several years. So you could say it was sort of a 6-year project of lots of effort. But what's interesting, writing a book about this, is when do you end the book? Mm-hmm. Because buying land, you can say, this is the day we bought it, now it's preserved, end of story. But really, that's just the beginning of the story. So this book acknowledges that land preservation is an ongoing adventure, and that taking care of the land and stewarding it and doing habitat restoration and getting human hearts continually engaged, it's not enough just for people to love it, to save it with fundraising. They have to love it through the generations to come, so they'll take care of it.
You do that because farm families are once again on the land that their forefathers owned.
Yes, and this is what's amazing is this is an environmental story, but it's a good news environmental
Absolutely.
Book. Absolutely. And how often do you see one of those? Mostly the books that are published about the Great Lakes or about the environment really have a lot of gloom in them because there's not oodles of good news about the environment these days. But this is a happy ending story, not just for the plants and animals and rare species, but also for the humans involved. And one group of people that has a happy ending in this book is many of the farm families were able to reclaim the land that they had farmed a generation ago, and now their kids are back on that same property.
So we should remind listeners where this is and how they can access it, because now it is extremely accessible.
Well, now the Arcadia Dunes it's a mix. It's a mix of private property owned by the farmers that have conservation easements on it, which means you can't go on that farmland, but you can know that there won't be houses and buildings built on it. But then there's also several thousand acres that's open to the public. And since this since the project ended, there's been about 16 miles of sustainably built trails added to the nature preserve, including wheelchair accessible trails. So people who are local can visit Arcadia Dunes, and it's right off M-22, just south of Frankfurt, To find Arcadia Dunes, you can look for road signs pointing out parking areas and trailheads when you're on M22, or you can Google the Conservancy has maps to the nature preserve.
So now this project is done, and what are you moving on to next?
Well, I always like to keep readers guessing what type of book I'm going to write next. So first it was parenting books, now Great Lakes environmental book. And what I've written next is a children's fiction book about ghosts. So it's a ghost adventure story.
And if listeners want more information about you and these books, they should go to?
My website is heathershoemaker.com.
Heather Shoemaker. The book again is?
Saving Arcadia.
Saving Arcadia. Thank you for being here.
Thanks
seeing
so
you
much.
Again.
Always a pleasure, Aaron.
You're listening to Michigan Writers on the Air on Interlochen Public Radio. Since 2005, Michigan Writers, the Traverse City-based organization, has sponsored a chapbook competition to help emerging writers publish their first book. One of the winners of the 2017 Michigan Writers Chapbook Competition is Nancy Parshall, and she's here in the studio with me today. Welcome, Nancy.
Thank you, Aaron.
Your chapbook is titled Proud Flesh. It's a collection of three short stories. How did you get started writing fiction?
Well, it was never my intention to write fiction, actually. I traveled a lot when I was younger, and in fact, I went to Australia to work on a fishing boat in 1985. And I went out on this boat and came back 6 weeks later with a mountain load of shrimp. We called them prawns down there. And whenever I told people the story of what happened on that fishing boat in that 6 weeks that we left land, me and two men that I knew for 3 minutes before we left land, and the time that we came back, whenever I told that story, people would say to me, "You have to write that." So for 30 years, I carried around this idea that I had a story to write, and it was memoir. And in fact, I started working on it at the Interlochen Writers Retreat 4 years ago. But then I took a class of flash fiction, and flash fiction is 500 to 1,000 words long, and realized that I really liked that. I liked making stories up rather than telling real ones. And so from there, I continued with the flash fiction, wrote a couple of longer pieces, and my ultimate goal is to go back to the memoir of the fishing boat. But for now, I've just enjoyed writing these stories.
This book of stories is titled Proud Flesh. Where did the title come from?
Yeah, that's an interesting story. Anyone who has a horse has probably heard of proud flesh. It's a scar tissue that is unsightly and looks kind of like a large head of cauliflower. Generally, it grows on a leg, and it's the result of a wound. I've since learned that proud flesh is something that humans can have too as scar tissue, but doctors these days are able to take care of it better than with horses. And usually it's when the skin is gone, and so there's nothing to stitch up in the horses. So one of the characters in the story is actually a horse, and he has proud flesh, this scar tissue. But it also works as a metaphor for all the characters because they're all scarred in some way.
So you are a teacher of writing at Northwestern Michigan. You've written for publication before, but this is quite different in that you had editors and other people helping you get this manuscript ready. Can you talk about that process?
Yeah. I tell my students at Northwestern Michigan College that no one writes in isolation. We need readers to help us. I encourage my students to work together with their peers to improve their drafts, to go to the writing center to improve their drafts. And the same is true for me and really all writers. None of us magically sit down at a computer and write a perfect draft. So I started by writing drafts of these pieces, and I got feedback from Katie Schultz, who was always my first reader. She's a writer herself, and she's able to see the holes in the stories, the places where I need to help develop characters or develop ideas or clarify things. And from there, I had friends read the stories until they were ready for publication, I thought. December 31st, 2016, I put forward the manuscript to the competition. In March, I learned that it had won the fiction portion of the competition. John Paul works with Michigan Writers Cooperative Press as the editor. He's also a former English instructor at Northwestern Michigan College. And he looked through the stories to see if there were missing commas or if there were places where things just didn't make sense. He, for example, found the word that I had used as airstream when I really meant contrail. So he said, let's change this word. It will make more sense. It's the proper word. And that was his job. He looked at this manuscript several times. Heather Shaw designed the cover and also designed the book. So the manuscript went from John Paul and me to Heather Shaw, who put it together. It was sent off and a proof came back, and we looked through that, and we found actually some things that in the process had changed a little bit. There was a spelling that I remember that somehow got changed. And so Heather Shaw then went and fixed that, and it went off then to be printed, and I received a box with lots of these little books. It was very, very exciting. It was the book I've been talking about for 30 years.
Nancy, can I get you to read one of the stories from Proud Flesh?
Sure. This story is called The Neighbors Will Take the Chickens. The rain doesn't surprise Molly, but she didn't expect it so early. She grabs a t-shirt and jeans from the laundry room, slops some coffee in the tall mug, fills the cat's food bowl, snatches an umbrella, and heads out before Frank is up. Molly sees rainy days as God's permission slip to take scenic drives along M22, sit in the Perk and Brew reading Good Housekeeping, visit Anne Helen. It doesn't matter what, she just doesn't want to ride Frank's rainy roller coaster. He punches holes in the drywall on rainy days. He suffers from nightmares, shame, Jim Beam. He says he hears the sound of wheels sliding on pavement, the crunch of metal, the girl's scream. He keeps her obituary on his desk. Frank, I'm home, Molly says. She struggles with bags at the door. Outside, the rain has stopped. Frank? Judge Judy sounds a warning in the TV room. Molly notices Frank brought the mail in and separated it in two piles, his and hers. His clean breakfast dishes rest in the drying rack, the counter wiped. He took over kitchen duties after being let go from his Dow Chemical sales job. They said they couldn't wait for him to complete his sentence. She creeps closer to the kitchen table. Winchester 22 Magnum bullets lay scattered. Dangerous within 1¾ miles, the silver box reads. Frank? She pushes the coats aside in the closet and finds Frank's rifle missing from the back corner. He gave up hunting years ago. She heads down the hall to the TV room, past family portraits on the wall, past his framed diplomas. Then, a gunshot. Finally. Molly wants to believe she lost Frank on the day of the accident, but really she lost him long before. She lost him in the early days when he made secret phone calls in the other room. She lost him during his fitness phase when he stayed late with Deborah, his swim coach. She lost him on that Bangkok business trip when he came home with crabs, something he said he got from Hilton hotel sheets. She was about to call it quits, to move on, when two rain-drenched policemen arrived at the door. Ma'am, there's been an accident. Your husband is okay and he's at the hospital. Your daughter is in worse shape. Frank and Molly didn't have a daughter. She leans against the hallway wall, pressed into the framed photographs of their wedding, their failed honeymoon. She thinks of the extravagant gifts Frank gave each time he met someone new. She thinks of how he ridiculed her for dropping out of secretarial school, for still not cooking meatloaf like his mother, how he withholds money. That time at the marriage encounter retreat when he announced to the group that she was bad in bed. The air around her feels thick, ready to burst. She pushes away from the wall and turns her back to the Judge Judy marathon. At the kitchen window, Molly stares at the barn. She expects to see flames or a blood fountain coming out of the roof, but everything looks normal. She wonders how long it will take to sell the house. Does she need to update the bathroom first? How much can she get for the pearls and diamonds in her jewelry box, the ones that other women earned? His BMW will provide a decent down payment for a condo. The neighbors will take the chickens. The kitchen faucet drips. Ping, ping, ping. She looks at her watch. She should call 911, but not too soon. If she waits 20 minutes and it takes 10 minutes to arrive, he'll be done, right? Smokey the cat walks through her legs, his tail trailing, massaging her calves. Molly startles when she sees the barn door swing open. The dog emerges first. Frank marches out, rifle over his shoulder like Elmer Fudd. His favorite hen, the only one he brought in the house on cold winter nights, the only one he picked blackberries for, the only one he allowed to free range, dangles upside down from his hand. She remembers him saying that Clucky wasn't doing well, that he'd euthanize her soon. She wipes a dead fly from the windowsill above the sink and turns off the dripping faucet. Opening the fridge, she pulls out ground beef. Tonight, it'll be her meatloaf.
Nancy Parshall reading from her chapbook, Proud Flesh. So, Nancy, what's next for you as a writer?
Well, I plan to write a full-length book of short stories, similar to Proud Flesh, with characters that are living in Michigan in rural areas. And also, I want to write that memoir about my fishing boat experience in Australia.
Well, you've told me about that, and I look forward to reading your memoir and your short stories. Nancy, where is this chapbook available from?
It's available on Amazon and also in Traverse City. Both Brilliant Books and Horizon Books have sections with books by local authors, and you should be able to find it there.
For more information about the Traverse City-based organization Michigan Writers or the Michigan Writers Cooperative Press, please check their website at www.mishwriters.org. Nancy, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me. It was my pleasure.
Fleeta Brown is here. Welcome, Fleeta.
Hi, Aaron. I'd like to introduce our audience today to the poet Kevin Goodin, G-O-O-D-I-N, and his new book called Let the Voices from Red Hen Press in 2016. I've been keeping up with Kevin's poems for years now, always with pleasure. He was raised on the Flathead Indian Reservation in western Montana and fought forest fires for 10 seasons with the U.S. Forestry Service. He teaches at Lewis Clark State College in Idaho. Gooden's poems are deeply and quietly musical and philosophical, which, considering the sometimes violent and angry subjects, is pretty much a surprise. In this book, which is his fourth full-length collection, he goes back to his roots in a trailer court. Here's a short poem to give you the flavor. Herbicide planes arc up, white mist floats over crops, train tracks, the first rows of the trailer court, over dogs that no longer bark at overhead rumbles. Chemical glaze windows, aluminum siding, propane tanks, children ride in games after school, thin grass between trailers Zelda mows, and open doors of trailers drifting into dreams of mothers, sons wheezing in their laps. Dust plays a big role in this collection. There is so much bad happening here, so much dangerous dust. But the poem itself is so beautifully spoken. Well, the circumstances seem all the worse for that. I should mention that these poems have no title. They're indented a few spaces in from the first line, which in a way makes that line a title. The title of this poem would be Herbicide Plains Arc Up. The poems are spoken from a distance, looking back with a clear-headedness that I wouldn't call nostalgia. It's more like quiet witness. Yet, well, this next poem I want to read you has the tone I mean. And if you wanted to call it a title, the title would be There Is the Uncertain Grace. There is the uncertain grace of the disappeared as we remember them, walking into an early morning garden, leather of their good shoes bleared with dew, as further on farmers wait to cut alfalfa until day cures out, and beyond field the sewer lagoon twists up its steam as creosote softens on railroad ties, the tracks that run darkly to the mill, the murky rise on the other side that is Solomon's dairy reeking. Suddenly we find that we too have entered the garden, are standing now in lush rows, the susurrus of the mind stills. We touch what leaves they've touched, as meadowlarks on power poles stitch the moment together, as dust lifts from the far road, as we call out the names so we do not live on empty. There's no period at the end of this poem. The poem is, in a way, a tour de force, calling out the names of what matters, even if it reeks, even if it's mucky and leaking creosote. Keeping these things in mind, both lovely and dark, so we don't live on empty. I think uncertain grace is how we see this landscape. In these poems, there are friends in prison, friends who have died, their knives and pooled blood, quote, topography of the past, as Gooden calls it in one poem. The map grows and brightens with an awareness that those who seem to be gone have been beside us all along. In fact, the poems in this book all seem to me to be concerned with the nature of memory. There's the story memory. There's the memory that looks for patterns outside the frame of the narrative. It is said that we are sown into time, is the beginning of one poem. And it goes on, but the photographs are worn at the edges from our searching for what exists outside time. The feeling I have when I read these poems is an expansive forgiveness for the past. It is as if the music is greater than the dissonance, that the dissonance, like the clash of cymbals, is absorbed into the pattern of the symphony. Okay, here's another. And it begins, what, if anything, beholds the pattern? What, if anything, beholds the pattern? There must be within us some voice trembling the blood, its long and finite coursings, and for a moment we hover to the whisper as if this were the only moment we'd been living toward. And for that instant, the past and present flow at the same frequency, and suddenly all we've forgotten casts vivid shadows once more. The purple pedal car on the wraparound porch of the uneven house in July, the red baseball cap Doug Bell stole, was wearing when he drowned, the wild cowlick on the crown of Richie Siegert's head, the constant wheezing of Ellie Wheeler as she touched the mallet, the softest notes from the music teacher's xylophone during detention, which is the hum we feel as the moment passes, as we step once more into the day and alter the narrative. This poem is about memory, how it works, how past and present flow at the same frequency. We hear its whisper, the past becomes alive at the very moment when the moment is passing and everything is again changing. Who sees this? What sees this, if anything? That's the question of the book, I think. I'd like to read this one more poem that's a concrete example of the kind of forgiveness and clear vision I find in the whole collection. When Bobby Irvine drank himself to death in the eighth grade, it was my turn to altar boy a funeral. During Mass, before the row of family, I knelt, rang the hand bell, then rose before the altar, but the cassock's hem caught my heel, and I fell hard against the coffin, knocking it from the stays on its metal cart. As I rushed to set it right, apologized to his family, the mortician, the reddening priest. I thought of what Bobby might do if he'd seen what happened, realized he'd punch my shoulder hard. When he saw pain in my face, he'd laugh. With the back of his hand, wipe the punch away, saying, "Jokes, swappy jokes," just like he'd always done. The poet is Kevin Gooden, and the book is Let the Voices, from Red Hen Press, 2016.
Thank you, Fleeta. Thank you for listening to Michigan Writers on the Air. My thanks to Julie Bunton, Heather Shoemaker, Nancy Parshall, and Fleeta Brown for their time. Also, kudos to Daniel Wanchura for his skillful engineering and production work on this show. This program is a production of Interlochen Public Radio. Be sure to listen next time to Michigan Writers on the Air on IPR News Radio. Until then, I wish you great writing, great reading, and the best of all words. Thank you.